In the 17th chapter of the book of Acts, I know that Richard has begun nearly each class by discussing the journeys that the Apostle Paul is taking and where we are in the study as far as the timeline is concerned. And Donna, that's your cue. When we begin to look at the journeys of the Apostle Paul, relating that to the chapters of Acts, the first preaching tour, second and third, what chapters are we discussing?
The first one is 13 and 14, and then the second one is 15, 18, and then
18, 21
is the third.
All right, that's right. So this one lands us where? The second preaching journey, and he has left what city and then passes to Amphipolis and so forth on down to Thessalonica. What's been the place that we've been discussing for a period of time? The city of Philippi. And, of course, the familiar context of that with the conversion of Lydia and the conversion of the Philippian jailer. He travels then from Philippi through Amphipolis and Apollonia and came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. Now, we might note just here that not much said about Amphipolis and Apollonia, just traveled through there. But the work was to be done, as we note here, in the city of Thessalonica. I have a note that this was, at that time, the largest city of Macedonia. Now, one of the things we want to note is that Paul's practice generally was to go to larger cities and use them as a hub to spread the gospel in that particular area. And when he came to the city of Thessalonica, it tells us there was a synagogue of the Jews. That's not there by accident. We've been studying in Philippi that they went down to the riverside where they supposed was a place of prayer. And we had some discussion about whether or not there was a synagogue of Jews in Philippi, and I think the evidence is that they did not, because we have these women gathering down by the riverside. There was to be a certain number of men in a city, a certain number of Jewish people who would then establish a synagogue. And you might find it interesting to do some study about the beginning of synagogue type worship. But here we find in Thessalonica there was a synagogue of the Jews. Now in verse 2, it tells us that Paul, as his custom was, went in unto them. That expression, as his custom was, indicates that this was a well-established practice on behalf of the Apostle Paul to go to the Jews first. Why?
That's where they went to the synagogues to teach and learn about the scriptures.
Well, that's right. But why do you suppose that it became a custom to go to the Jews first, whether they be down by the riverside or in the synagogue? And you're right when you say, well, there'd be Jews there, but what's particularly important about these Jews?
They would have had all the Old Testament history and the preparation to hear the good news.
All right, that's right. We know that the law was read in the Jewish synagogues every day, or every Sabbath day. Bruce, James, and Randy. All right.
But also, it was told that that's where Paul would actually even start when he was knocked down to his knees and went to Damascus, and he was told what to do. And when he was told what to do, he was told that that's what he was going to be doing anyway.
All right. He went to the Jewish synagogues frequently. Let's see. Randy?
Well, I was going to throw in Romans 1:16.
All right. Very good.
It wasn't that Paul was doing this because he thought it was a good idea.
Right.
God had decreed that the Jews would always receive the gospel first.
All right.
They would have the first opportunity. Romans 1:16 is one passage that teaches that. And while you said there was somebody else ahead of me, so I was looking to see if I could find some others that would justify that.
Well, yes, James deferred his comments, but that's right. The gospel was to be preached to the Jew first and then to the Greeks, Romans 1:16. And as we look at that, I think there's some rationalization to that. The Jew had the law. Now that continues us in the book of Romans. In Romans, the first chapter, as we see the gospel being preached to the Jew first, then to the Gentiles, when we come to the latter part of the first chapter, we see the condition of the Gentile. When we come to the second chapter, we see that the Jew is no better. And when we come to the third chapter, the first few verses, the question is asked, what advantage then hath the Jew? Did the Jew have an advantage? Yes, he had the oracles of God. And these were read in the synagogue every Sabbath. So it would seem reasonable or even rational to expect that the apostle Paul, from a very Jewish background, would go to the Jews expecting them to have knowledge of the law and what had been said concerning the coming of a Savior. And so that became his established practice. Randy up front, Randy Giles.
Well, everything you just said, but the advantage the Jews had because they already believed the Scriptures was that they could be convinced that Jesus is the Christ that was prophesied throughout all the Scriptures. Going to the Gentiles meant preaching there's only one God first.
Well, that's right. Now, we know that the Jew had trouble with that before captivity, but in captivity he learned that there's only one God. And some suppose that it was in captivity that the idea of the Jewish synagogue originated. But be that as it may, what we see is that in Paul's time, it would be a correct assumption that the Jew believed that there's one God, and they believed the Scriptures. Okay, Randy?
I'm not trying to get ahead, but compare the difference of Paul's preaching in Philippi and Thessalonica to when we're going to get to Acts.
Oh, yes. Yes. Stark contrast.
Well, all that is true, but at the same time, when we read of Jesus' ministry, how many times did we find him saying, you do err not knowing the Scriptures?
Yes.
To the Jews.
To the Jews, yes. Now, that's an interesting observation. Not that they didn't know what it said, but their understanding right. of what it said. Was skewed. And that's, I think, very crucial. Now, you mentioned Randy Bowles, other passages that talked about the Jew first and then the Gentile. Just recently, in Acts the 13th chapter, we were studying about Paul preaching in Antioch of Pisidia, where he went into the Jewish synagogue. And the reaction of the Jews there certainly was adverse. And then in the latter part of that chapter, we saw in verse 44 of Acts 13 that the next Sabbath, almost the whole city was gathered together to hear the word of God. But when the Jews saw the multitudes, they were filled with jealousy and contradicted the things which were spoken by Paul and blasphemed. And what was the reaction of Paul in the latter part of the 13th chapter? When the Jews rejected what he had to say to them, to whom did he go? He went to the Gentiles. And that is, as you'll note, in verse 46 and 47, a matter of prophecy. That the Jews would reject it and he would go then to the Gentiles. But our point here is that in Thessalonica, going back to the 17th chapter, that in Thessalonica, it was his custom to go in unto the Jews. And in verse 2, we want to note the time frame. It says he went in unto them for three Sabbath days. Now, that's not very long before trouble begins to arise. Three Sabbath days in the synagogue in Thessalonica. Now, in verse 2, the latter part of that verse, it says he reasoned with them from the Scriptures. Now, that, again, gives us the foundation that he expected to find among the Jews. He would expect to find them familiar with the Scriptures. Now, going into this Jewish synagogue and expecting them to find, or to find them familiar with the Old Testament Scriptures. Often when we're trying to teach that Jesus is the Christ, we'll go back and pull some Old Testament prophecies of what was said about the coming of Jesus. And I think a man by the name of, well, I think his first name was Henry, last name Liddon, I believe, came up with a list of about 332 very specific prophecies about the coming of the Messiah that were found in the Old Testament. Now, I don't know how many of those the Apostle Paul used. We're not told. But it tells us that he used the Scriptures, opening and alleging that it behooved the Christ to suffer and to be crucified or killed and be raised from the dead on the third day. Now, could he use the Old Testament to show that? Could he use the ministry of Jesus, and keep in mind that Jesus lived under the terms of the Old Testament? Here's what Jesus said would occur in his life and how his life would end. Do you suppose that the Apostle Paul is saying, look here, what the Old Testament said, here's what Jesus said would happen, and here's just exactly what happened? Now, what does that provide evidence for? This Jesus, whom you crucified, is the Christ. Now, keep in mind that when we look at Thessalonica, Thessalonica is located in what province?
Macedonia.
Macedonia. Do you think it would be a fair assessment to say that in that first Pentecost following the resurrection of Christ, that there very well may have been Jews from Macedonia who had come down to Jerusalem to observe those feast days? Well, we have in the second chapter of the book of Acts to note that there were folks from all over everywhere, devout Jews from all over the world that had come to Jerusalem to observe these feast days. And it's entirely possible that some in that crowd were there that Paul's addressing. That's speculation, certainly, on my part. I can't prove that, but I think it's a fair assessment to say that likely some were there who were familiar with these things. And so he's declaring unto them that Jesus was to suffer, and or that the Christ was to suffer, to rise again from the dead, and that this Jesus, whom, said he, I proclaim unto you, is the Christ. Now the wording of that is particularly interesting to me, because it becomes the effort of the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter and others that we might read about to establish that this Jesus is the Christ. You see reference to that, I think, very clearly stated in Acts chapter 2, where in verse 22, the Apostle Peter is presenting some things they already knew about this Jesus that they had crucified and that was buried and that God raised from the dead. Now, they disputed that God had raised him from the dead for the most part, but Peter spends the rest of his sermon establishing in Acts chapter 2 that this Jesus, whom ye crucified, we are witnesses that God raised him from the dead. Therefore, draw the line, add it up. What's the conclusion? Who is this Jesus? Now, Jesus was a common name during that time, but he's identifying somebody specifically. This Jesus, the one that you crucified, the one that lived among you and performed miracles, and you know these things. Ye yourselves know, he said. God raised him from the dead. We saw him. Now what conclusion does Peter draw? Who is this Jesus? He's the Christ. That's right. Now do you see the Apostle Paul presenting very similar evidence here among these in the synagogue in Thessalonica? You know, the evidence hasn't changed, and that evidence is overwhelmingly powerful. We see in Acts 2 it was powerful to prompt the question, what shall we do? And I want to suggest to you that here in Thessalonica, the evidence is equally powerful. But people don't always respond to the power of the gospel the same way, do they? David?
So you mentioned that maybe possibly some Jews from Thessalonica here were there in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost when Peter preached the first gospel sermon. But at the same time, if they were, they had to have heard about it.
Oh, absolutely.
Because Paul makes that point to King Agrippa. Do you know these things happen?
Yeah.
They didn't happen in the corner. So they too, weren't there, they had to have heard about it from either fellow Jews or maybe some that were there, came and reported these things.
Yeah.
So they had to have known all these things that Jesus did.
Yeah. Now, interestingly enough, in this passage, it tells us that he opened and alleged. Well, what did he open and allege?
I was starting to point out over in Acts 2:5, It says there were Jews living in Jerusalem, devout men from every nation under heaven. So whether or not their language is listed down below, it says every nation.
Yeah, there were likely some there from Macedonia and Achaia. And well, we know that the text identifies specifically that there were sojourners as far away as Rome. So yes, we've got people from all over that are there. So yes, it's likely that some were there, and it's certain that they heard of what had taken place. These Jews in this synagogue that Paul is addressing. Now, when you identify the Jews in the synagogue, we mentioned a moment ago that not all of the recipients of the gospel reacted to it the same way. We saw that in the city of Jerusalem in Acts 2. When the same evidence was presented by Peter, they said, "What shall we do?" And when Stephen presented the same evidence in Acts chapter 7, what did they do? They stoned him to death. So the reaction is kind of up in the air, you know, what to expect when you come into the city of Thessalonica. You'd like to think that here's the synagogue of the Jews, that they'll believe the evidence and everything will go well. But that's not a foregone conclusion. If you'll notice further in Acts the 17th chapter, Paul said that it behooved the Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead, and that this Jesus, whom said he, I proclaim unto you, is the Christ. Now he did that frequently. We see evidence of that in Acts 9, right after his conversion, that this Jesus is the Christ. He is who he claimed to be. And I think the timing of the text in Acts chapter 9, just following Paul's conversion, is significant. He's learned something that aforetime he had denied, and now he sees the overwhelming, compelling evidence. You see it again in Acts 18 in a couple of passages, that this Jesus is the Christ. Now, verse 4 is rather interesting in some respects, because it gives a typical response to the preaching. Notice, if you will, Paul said, I proclaim. What is a preacher? That's a proclaimer. Paul's preaching to them. Now, you see in this passage, essentially, what a preacher does. He presents the evidence. And that's what he did. Here's the Old Testament text. Here's what we witnessed. Here's what we are declaring to you. Here's the foregone conclusion. He's preaching to them. Which tells us that preaching is not just ranting and raving and receiving some kind of mystical revelation, as one might perceive, that occurs so many times in denominationalism. Paul's presenting evidence. And that's what we're to do. When we preach, you present evidence. Now, some respond differently to the evidence that's presented. Same evidence. It says in verse 4, and some of them were persuaded and consorted with Paul and Silas, and of the devout Greeks a great multitude, and of the chief women not a few, but the Jews being moved with jealousy, and we'll talk about what they did by way of contrast. So now we've got a stark contrast, much like you were referring to, Randy, in the approach that's used between Jews and Gentiles. Here, same evidence presented to Jews, and we've got a stark contrast in its reception. Some of them were persuaded. Now, the thing that I want to pause for just a moment on regarding that is to take us over to 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. Now, you've read ahead and you know that in Thessalonica things for the most part did not go well. They were essentially run out of town. And yet we know he was there for a relatively short period of time, but though the results varied, we have in this text of Acts 17 some that became believers. They were persuaded. But we also have two epistles that are written to the church in Thessalonica to tell us that though Paul was there for only a short time, that the effect of his work was profound. There is a church in Thessalonica, and I want to talk with you about some of that from the books of 1 and 2 Thessalonians, because much of our information about the church there and the result of Paul's work there is not found in Acts. It's found in these epistles. And it would be an injustice to just ignore these epistles and talk about this limited information we have in Acts. But we know that though he was there for a short time, look at verse 13 of 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. It tells us, "For this cause we also thank God without ceasing, that when you received from us the word of the message, even the word of God, ye accepted it not as the word of men, but as it is in truth the word of God, which also worketh in you that believed." Now, look at that carefully. When Paul was there presenting evidence in Thessalonica, there were those who had honest and good hearts, and they examined it and were careful about their application of it, and they believed it. Now, the text here in Acts identifies that as some. But what did they do with it? This some, we might look at that and say, well, that was by way of comparison. You know, we've got the largest city of Macedonia, and here's the synagogue, and some of those in the synagogue believed what Paul said. So, proportionately, we have a very small element here that has accepted what Paul has said to be the Word of God. But what did they do with it? Anyone? Well, again, 1 Thessalonians, Randy.
Except that it is the Word of God.
They did. But if you'll back up in the text up here to 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, it says, beginning in verse 6, "And ye became imitators of us and of the Lord, having received the Word in much affliction with joy of the Holy Spirit, so that you became an ensample to all that believe in Macedonia and Achaia. For from you has sounded forth the word of the Lord, not only in Macedonia and Achaia, but in every place your faith to Godward is gone forth, so that we need not to speak anything. For they themselves report concerning us what manner of entering in we had unto you, and how you turned from God unto God from idols to serve a living and true God, and to wait for His Son from heaven, whom He raised from the dead, even Jesus, who delivereth us from the wrath to come." This some here in Thessalonica, some, no doubt, in the synagogue, and some, no doubt, as we see, a larger proportion of those who were Greeks, it tells us in verse 4 of chapter 17, and of the chief women, not a few. Paul's influence in Thessalonica as a result of his teaching has been dramatic, hasn't it? There's been a great result from teaching in the synagogue in the city of Thessalonica. Randy, you look like you're about to say something.
I just going to say, this instance in Thessalonica and others reminds me so much of the parable of the soil.
Oh, yes. Yes, you've got different hearts that react differently to the same evidence that's presented. But Paul's work results in the establishment of a church here in Thessalonica. Now, before we move too much farther about these vile fellows and being thrown out of the city and all of that sort of thing, I want to say a little bit more about what we might perceive to be a small beginning in Thessalonica. Short period of time, small beginning. Paul addresses this in these epistles. And I want to call your attention to the third chapter of 1 Thessalonians. The third chapter of 1 Thessalonians. I'm going to read, beginning in verse 1, a few verses, down through about verse 10, because I think there's a point to be made here that often is overlooked. In verse 1, he said, "Wherefore, when we could no longer forbear, we thought it good to be left behind at Athens alone, and sent Timothy, our brother, and God's minister in the gospel of Christ, to establish you and to comfort you concerning your faith." And let's pause right there. We're not done. But we know that Paul has traveled from Thessalonica, and we know in the Acts account, chapter 17, he then goes to Berea, and then he comes on down to Athens, and that takes up the bulk of the study in the 17th chapter of the book of Acts. But we're going to note in our study of the 17th chapter that Silas and Timothy were left in Berea. And when Paul comes down here to Athens, what does he see? All right, the city just filled with idols. And those who brought him down there, he sends them back up to Berea with a message for Silas and Timothy. What was the message? Come right away with all speed. This passage helps us to see that they did. At least that Timothy did. I think there's evidence that Silas did too. But what we see in this passage is certainly that Timothy did. Because it tells us that when we could no longer forbear, we thought it good to be left behind at Athens alone and sent Timothy. So where's Paul? He's here in Athens. He has sent for Silas and Timothy, but by the writing of the 1 Thessalonian letter, we see evidence that Timothy was present with him later on in Athens and is sent back to Thessalonica. Now, why? Remember, we're studying the importance of this small beginning in Thessalonica. What's Paul's concern? Why did he send Timothy back?
Establish and exhort
them. Establish and exhort them. In verse 3, he said that no man be moved by these afflictions, for yourselves know that hereunto we were appointed. For verily, when we were with you, we told you beforehand that we are to suffer affliction, even as it came to pass. And ye know. Now, is he talking to people who knew just exactly what happened in Acts 17? He sure is. We told you about that. We experienced it, and now you're experiencing it.
Back in 1 Thessalonians 1, 9.
Okay.
Because they themselves report about us what kind of reception we have with you and how you turned to God from idols to serve a living and true God. So they were converting idol worshippers.
Yes.
Where did they come from? They wouldn't have been in the synagogue, right?
No. But what it does tell us is that Paul's work included Greeks in Thessalonica. Now, that's an interesting note that you would ask that. He reasoned for 3 Sabbath days in the Jewish synagogue. But you'll also notice in verse 4, some of them were persuaded and consorted with Paul and Silas, and of the devout Greeks, a great multitude. Some believe that these were Greeks who had turned from idols and were serving God as they could in the Jewish synagogue. Perhaps proselytes, yes. That's possible. But we know that from that, we've got a great beginning. Keeping in mind now that the populace, the general populace of Macedonia and Achaia, and even over here in Asia where we've been studying, the general populace was Greek. There were Jews scattered among them, of course, but the general populace were Greek, and they had turned from idols to serve a living and true God. Now, we're going to have occasion to revisit that when we get down to the city of Athens and talk about the city that was filled with idols. But yes, there was idolatry in Thessalonica. There was idolatry, no doubt, in Philippi. And we know that there was idolatry over here in Asia, in Ephesus, as we'll see in Acts 19 when we get to there. There was idolatry and not only in Athens, but also in Corinth, just a few miles away. Some of the very basis of practices, as we've talked about before, existed in Corinth. So, yes, to elaborate that there were Greeks in Thessalonica who learned what Paul was teaching and turned from the practices of idols is amplified in this text of 1 Thessalonians. Yeah. Randy? Okay, well, going back to 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, I want you to look again at verse 5. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 5. Now, Paul's already mentioned this statement. You see it there in verse 1. He said, "For this cause I also, when I could no longer forbear, sent that I might know your faith." Well, who did he send? Verses 1 and 2. He sent Timothy. That's right. Couldn't forbear. I sent Timothy. Now here's Paul down here in the city of Athens, and you, having studied ahead, know what's there in Acts chapter 17, city filled with idols, and what's on his mind? He's just overwhelmed with this city filled with idols, but what's on his mind about Thessalonica? We got about the same thing up there. And you've got a church up there that is composed of Jews and Greeks, that is just an infant church. Their faith is not strong. There's a lot of things they don't know. And how are they going to fare in the midst of persecution? Now, what you would do is probably get your iPhone out and send them a message and say, hey, what's going on up there in Thessalonica? Well, they couldn't do that. Even snail mail would be faster than the communication they would have with Thessalonica. So what does he do? He sends Timothy. Send a man up there to find out what's going on. Now, you'll note in verse 5, once again, 1 Thessalonians 3, for this cause I also, when I could not forbear, he said, sent that I might know your faith, lest by any means the tempter had tempted you, and our labor should be in vain. Paul concerned about him, isn't he? He said, but when Timothy came, even now unto us from you, and brought us glad tidings of your faith and love, and that ye have good remembrance of us always, longing to see us, even as we also to see you. For this cause, brethren, we were comforted over you in all our distress and affliction through your faith. For now we live if you stand fast in the Lord. Now, I think there's overwhelming evidence that when Paul sent Timothy from Athens back up here to Thessalonica, it took some time for him to travel, get the information that was needed and the evidence that was needed, and then to come back and catch up with Paul, who by that time is over at Corinth, where it appears 1 Thessalonians was written. Now, interestingly enough, Timothy, when he comes back, he brings good news. Got good news. And what do we know? And I can't recall the proverb, Richard. You'll have to help me here if you have your computer available, where good news is like cold water to the thirsty. But Paul receives good news, a real good report from those up there in Thessalonica. Now, let me ask you, brethren. Lancaster is kind of known as an area where folks are kind of in and out. And those of you who have been here for a while know that that's so because of the occupations that this area represents. And no doubt some of you have been with congregations in times gone by, and maybe you have been away for a while and you have some concerns about how they fare. And then before long, somebody comes along that has worshipped there recently, had some communication with folks there, and they tell you about how things are. Have you ever been just terribly disappointed? Just absolutely brokenhearted because of the report that you received? Have you been just absolutely elated because things are going good? You receive that report? Now, I don't see as many heads on the good side as I did a while ago on the bad side. But every once in a while you hear good things. And you have occasion to rejoice. They're growing. Things are going well. And that's what Paul is hearing from Timothy here in 1 Thessalonians chapter 3. And he said, we received glad tidings, verse 6, of your faith and love, and that you have good remembrance of us always, longing to see us, even as we also to see you. Now, the majority of the folks in Thessalonica didn't care whether Paul lived or died. But here in the church, they want to see him.
Proverbs 25:25.
Why can't I remember that? 25:25. Remember that. That's what good news is like.
And the report was so good. Much later, Paul is writing about the church in Macedonia in his second letter to the Corinthians. And now this is going to include Philippi, but he's talking about the churches there in Macedonia. But he's talking about how generous they had been in helping him. But in verse 5 of chapter 8, they gave themselves first to the Lord, then by the will of God to us. I mean, that, there's a huge sermon just in that.
Oh, big time. Yeah.
And but that is an idea of just what kind of good report I think that Timothy is able to give.
Well, that's right. That's right. So encouraging to receive this kind of good news. And you'll note further in the text of 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, as he continues in verse 7, he said, for this cause, brethren, we were comforted over you in all our distress and affliction through your faith. Now, where Paul is now in Corinth, man, what a wicked place to be. And to receive this good news about folks in Thessalonica was kind of like a breath of fresh air, a drink of cold water to a thirsty man. Now, in verse 8, he says, "For now we live if you stand fast in the Lord." Now, brethren, look at that carefully. We live if you stand fast. Don't ever think, brethren, that what we're doing here in Lancaster may not have any effect anywhere else. Because what you do here, other folks might learn about and be encouraged. Or what you do here, other folks might learn about and it just be devastating to them. But you see, what took place in Thessalonica, Paul said, we live if you stand fast. It provides life to us. What encouragement. But the point I'm looking for is just a little further down. In verse 9, he said, "For what thanksgiving can we render again unto God for you? For all the joy wherewith we joy for your sakes before our God, night and day, praying exceedingly that we may see your face and may perfect that which is lacking in your faith." Now, all the zeal and enthusiasm and the "I want to see you, wish I could be with you," that's all fine, well, and good. All the good things we're hearing about you, that's all fine, well, and good. But had the brethren in Thessalonica arrived at spiritual maturity?
They still needed to be taught.
Paul's desire was to see them and be with them so he could perfect that which is lacking. Now, in the reading of the first and second epistles to the church in Thessalonica, we can identify a lot of things that they were not lacking. Their zeal and enthusiasm, their commitment to Paul, their commitment to the Lord, their love for the truth, and all those things, we've underscored that already. But there are still areas in their faith that's lacking. They need to grow. And let me suggest to you that that's an ever-present quality in our life. We all need to grow. But Paul's desire was to go himself and to perfect that which is lacking in your faith. Now, did he have some reason to suspect that there might be some things lacking? Well, he'd only been there a short time. The results were good. But we're going to read later that when he came to Ephesus, how long did he stay there?
3 years.
Do you think you could do a whole lot more in 3 years than you could do in just about a month? There's a lot that needs to be done in Thessalonica. And though they're doing well, there's still more to be done. Chris?
Verse 5 of 1 Thessalonians 3 impresses me that everywhere that Paul went, when he left, Satan didn't leave.
That's right.
You know, that he moved on, but he talked about the tempter remaining. And so not only was their faith not yet complete, but he knew that the adversary was continuing to work on the brethren there. And that was a good point.
Very good point. Yes, very good point. So this is what's happening in Thessalonica. And going back now to the book of Acts, what we see in the 17th chapter is very brief about Paul's work in Thessalonica, and the degree of success appears to be small, but yet we note that there were some Jews that were converted. There were some Greeks that are described as God-fearing, Randy, which indicates that perhaps these were Greek proselytes, as they may have been in the Jewish synagogue. But I think there's evidence that there were others who were Greeks that perhaps, like Cornelius, they've been taught to fear God, but they don't know what they need to do to be Christians. And Paul's telling them. And so we see that there are a number of folks, though maybe small, in the city of Thessalonica that constitute the beginning of the church here. Now, we talked about the Jews and the synagogue in Thessalonica and to some degree. And we talked about the different responses that some have to the gospel. Now, we've discussed, for the most part, the pluses. But let's look at the negative side of that now. If you'll turn back to Acts 17 at verse 5. Acts 17, verse 5. It says, "But the Jews, being moved with jealousy, took unto them certain vile fellows of the rabble, and gathering a crowd, set the city on an uproar, and assaulting the house of Jason, they sought to bring them forth to the people. Several interesting thoughts in verse 5. The Jews, being moved with jealousy, you might be correct to conclude that these were the unbelieving Jews. They didn't accept what Paul had to say. And look at their reaction. Same evidence presented to them that was presented to others. They just rejected the evidence. Now, the question is sometimes raised in our Bible studies with people who are not Christians. We present the evidence, and some receive it, and some don't. Why not?
Because they don't want
to. Yeah, and there are a variety of reasons. Randy hit on this a moment ago when he talked about the parable of the sower, Luke chapter 8. There are different kinds of hearts. Some are receptive, some are not. By far, the few may be receptive. The majority will reject it. And in this instance, look at the extent that some went to cause problems for Paul as they rejected what he had presented. Evidence or no? I mean, they just categorically rejected. And it said they took unto themselves certain vile fellows. They were moved with jealousy, the verse tells us. And they took certain vile fellows. What was it that caused Jesus to be crucified? What did the leaders of the Jews do there in Jerusalem? All right, jealousy. Pilate knew that for envy or jealousy they had delivered him up. And what did they do? They sought to find witnesses, false witnesses. And the text tells us initially they could find none. And then they found certain vile fellows. What's a vile fellow?
Scumbag.
Okay.
All the trash they can find, you can have all the trouble riled up.
Okay. All right. Ready?
Somebody willing to lie for money.
Yes. Yeah. Somebody willing to lie for money. And that's what we've got here. They found certain vile fellows of the rabble, and gathering a crowd, set the city on an uproar. Now, notice, if you will, that's the intent of these vile fellows. That's what their job is. Stir up everybody and cause problems for Paul and
Silas. Paul was concerned for them.
Pardon me?
Still wonder Paul was concerned for them that he sent Timothy there.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Just as evidence of what.
Yes. Yes. And against that backdrop, David, that these in the church now, in 1 Thessalonians that we're reading about, they've witnessed this kind of thing happening to Paul. They were there. They saw it. And his concern is, in chapter 3, verse 1 of 1 Thessalonians, that no man be moved by these afflictions, for yourselves know that hereunto we are appointed. For verily, when we were with you, we told you beforehand that we are to suffer affliction, even as it came to pass. And you know. You yourselves know. So, yes. Look at what happened to us when we were there. And expect that. That's what's going to happen to you. Now, Paul's concerned that that kind of persecution might cause their faith to fail. And as we see in Paul's writing to the young preacher Timothy, don't be ashamed of me. Don't be ashamed of these afflictions. Because that's what happens. You preach the truth, that's just what's going to happen. And these in Thessalonica, they needed to catch on to that idea right quick. And we've already noted in our study, chapter 14, was it? That through much afflictions, you enter the kingdom. And that's what he's not only telling them, but he's demonstrated before these in Thessalonica. Any question or comment just here before we pursue? Randy, and then Noah.
Let me throw this out as a sort of a interesting investigation that could be done over the next week here. In this, twice here in this account in Acts 17, verse 6, they were, Jason was dragged before the city authorities, and then later on that same word in verse 8 is employed. The word there is politarch, Greek word, P-O-L-I-T-A-R-C-H. It does not appear in any non-biblical passages, no Greek documents, do we have any reference to a politarch. This is the only place, these two places, where that appears. Consequently, Luke in the book of Acts has suffered great attacks over the centuries because of this. More arguments that here Luke's just inventing stuff. Leave it as a research for people to look up that word Polycarp, P-O-L-T-I-C-H-A-R-K. Look up that Greek word and see what you can find out about it over the next.
Okay, that'd be interesting. And that's represented here as the rulers.
The rulers. I could give you the report, but I don't want to take it away. I think it's good research.
Yeah, okay. Keep that in mind. I'll try not to forget it. Make a note of it here. That's interesting. I know that in times gone by there have been questions regarding the authenticity of the text because people were referred to in the text by terms that were not used in known secular writings. But then through process of time, something came about and now here we have it. We find the documents where it did exist. And so, yes, Paul knew what he was talking about. Luke knew what he was talking about. Yeah. We'll look further at that. All right, in verse 5, got the city on an uproar. And it says they assaulted the house of Jason. You might do some research on who Jason was. Some have speculated that there was some kind of a relationship, family relationship between Paul and Jason. I don't know if that's true or not, but he's identified here. And certain brethren they dragged before the rulers, and they created problems. While you're researching and studying that, the text tells us, I want to throw this out, and you take some time and look it up. In verse 9, it said, when they had taken security from Jason and the rest, they let them go. Do some work on that word security and what the rulers did in this instance. Okay, before they let these men go. Thank you.